I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. Coming up, an interview with Rishi Manchanda, co-founder of Health Begins and author of the TED book, The Upstream Doctors. But first, Gary Schweitzer, publisher of healthnewsreview.org, is with us to review the week's health news, including a story about a baby cured of HIV. He's on the line from his home office in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Gary.
John, good to join you.
This week we learned about a cure for HIV. A baby was cured. Tell us a little bit about the story and how did the media do in covering this one?
Well, we got to watch what we call a cure, and this is not a news story. So about a year ago, we heard about a baby being born with HIV who was apparently cured through aggressive drug treatment hours after birth. And then this week, what brought it back in the news again, there was a big AIDS conference, and there was an announcement of a second such baby born and treated and apparently doing well. Now, I could focus on a lot of different news stories, but I'm going to look at what arguably is the best, the New York Times, which reported that this new announcement leaves little doubt that the treatment works. I don't think we can say that at all. And in fact, the story itself negates that, because it went on to report, now there's going to be a trial in up to 60 babies, and if that works, and it's going to take several years of following the babies to show this, then maybe the way we treat the 250,000 babies like this who are born each year will be changed. But those are a lot of ifs. Now, in comparison, the Associated Press reported a quote, "We don't know if the baby is in remission, but it looks like that," said a UCLA doctor who had consulted on the girl's care. So a couple of take-home points for me, John, from this. Number one, let's just slow down and breathe deeply. Number two, let's not rush to judgment after one, two, even 10 or more patients. And now there is some indication there may be more reports of babies like this, at least in Canada. So we're going to hear this all over again. And then number three, as I started off, what do we really mean by cure? As the UCLA doc said, we don't even know if this baby is in remission. So I would just say to the audience, whenever you hear the word cure, throw up the healthy skeptic shield. And number four, from personal experience, I'll tell you, I worked at a place, CNN, back in the 80s, that reported an AIDS cure after just one patient. And the network and the researchers were later embarrassed. I don't think that journalists want to be part of that kind of experience again.
Right. Everyone's looking for the scoop, but you certainly don't want to look back in embarrassment. So let's go to the opposite end of the AIDS spectrum. Another big story was that there might be a test for Alzheimer's, a blood test that could predict whether or not you will go on, a 70 or so year old will go on to develop Alzheimer's. What did you think of these breathless claims?
Well, if the first warning was run for the hills if you hear the word cure, I'll tell you again, run for the hills whenever you hear the phrase simple blood test, which was repeated many times about this new report on an Alzheimer's test. CNN stated that this new test had, quote, astonishing accuracy. Meantime, though, MedPage Today reported the accuracy fell short of what you would normally consider acceptable for a screening test. So which way is it? Astonishing accuracy or not good enough for what we'd normally call a screening test? Well, I think MedPage Today got it right. They took the extra step of reporting on something that I'm not going to be able to fully explain because we don't have a half hour for this here. But the positive predictive value of the test was just 35%. What that means is almost two-thirds of positive screening results would be false. That's what positive predictive value means. And this story made clear, be aware that the positive predictive value of a test depends on the prevalence of the disease in the population studied. So if you're going to do large-scale screening of healthy people, you're going to have an unacceptably high false positive rate. Maybe targeted screening of high-risk people would make more sense. But we didn't get that from most of the stories that reported on the promise of this so-called simple blood test. Really concerning when you think about how many people are dealing with Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, and around the same time as that story came out, we learned that perhaps Alzheimer's has moved up to the number three cause of death. And for some reason, the way you reported on the reporting of that story about the blood test, it reminded me of this old Jerry Lewis movie, Hook, Line, and Sinker, where he gets falsely told that he's going to die. So he goes out and does a bunch of crazy things. I mean, if we have two-thirds of the people with a positive test getting a false positive and planning accordingly, that's obviously incredibly anxiety-provoking and disruptive. So I also saw a post you had over at Health News Review about another test that's going to predict if you'll be alive in 5 years. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, this is going to sound like we're picking on CNN week, and that's not by design. We just deal with the hand that we've been dealt. Some of this stuff just falls in your lap. But CNN reported a test may someday predict your five-year risk of death. And they wrote, will you be alive 5 years from now? New research suggests it might be possible to predict. How? With a simple blood test. We go again. The simple blood test that looked at four biomarkers, four biological molecules found in your blood, in your body fluids, or your tissues. Well, you know what? I looked at the study, and you don't need to look any further than this very clear chapter heading. What do these findings mean in the published study? And what did it say in there? However, there are several limitations to this study. As an observational study, we've already talked about this in one of our previous weeks, it provides evidence of only a correlation between the biomarker and ill health. It does not identify any underlying cause. Therefore, we don't even know for sure if this will provide any clinical benefit. So the fact that we would trumpet this as a test that, as they said here, will help you predict if you'll die from a condition in the next half decade just shows some of the testing and screening madness, John, that we see in so many news reports.
I guess it's the biological equivalent of tarot cards. One for the road, Gary. You want to talk about Brazilian butt lift operations. What do you know about these?
Well, it's not that I want to talk about it, but again, some of these just fall in your lap. So recently we had Fox News, NBC News, many news sources reporting on statistics from these specialist surgeons who do this kind of work, that saying that more Americans are getting butt lifts. Well, let's face it, I think the surgeons love this publicity because it may become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more you get the word out about more people wanting butt lifts, the more people might actually want them. So NBC quoted a plastic surgeon saying people see J-Lo, they see Beyonce, and they want to look like that. But CNN, once again, gave over its health website to a column by a plastic surgeon who called 2013 the year of the butt. And their website showed a picture of some of these butts, and the caption read, Kim Kardashian's booty may inspire patients to seek butt enhancement surgery. Something jumped out at me there. Patients. The definition of patient is somebody who gets medical treatment, or a sick person. Now, there might be something sick about people who want to get butt lifts, but it is not medical treatment. And I wouldn't call them patients. They're guinea pigs. I do lose my patience with the way a lot of news space is given over to junk like this, when we've got a lot more pressing things that we should be covering. So, John, you know, as we wrap up here, I just want to say I really thank you for these past 4 weeks. It's been fun talking with you. I hope that it's helped the audience scrutinize healthcare news and claims about healthcare, and maybe we can do this again in the future.
Gary, thank you so much, and you can read his stuff at his website, healthnewsreview.org. Thanks, Gary.
We'll meet again.
Gary Schweitzer has been a health journalist for 40 years, including a stint at CNN in the early 1980s. He publishes the website, healthnewsreview.org. I'm John Schumann. This is Medical Matters. Follow us online at glasshospital.com. Just look for Medical Matters. Or send us an email, glasshospital@gmail.com. Medical science has evolved greatly from the days of bloodletting and castor oil. Nowadays, we think of targeting treatment at individuals and their specific variant of disease, as with different kinds of cancer or autoimmune diseases. Increasingly, medical science has expanded to include a concept known as the social determinants of health. This is the idea that the genetic lottery, namely where and to whom you're born, has an enormous impact on your health as you grow and develop. For instance, were you nurtured in childhood or did you suffer abuse? What educational opportunities were available to you? Did you have access to healthy food and clean drinking water? For billions of people on Earth, the answer is no. Too frequently, patients come to see doctors in our offices, and we prescribe a bromide for what ails them, and it may or may not work. But sadly, doctors are unable to fix so much of what is broken. Will an antibiotic cure chronic deprivation? Can an anti-inflammatory treat an unequal or overtaxing workplace? My guest today, physician Rishi Manchanda, thinks deeply about such issues. He's not only a doctor, but a crusader for social justice. He co-founded a nonprofit called Health Begins to address the disparities in health that occur upstream of the point of care, often decades before a patient enters the doctor's office. He's written about it in his TED book, published by the folks that bring you TED Talks and the TED Radio Hour, called The Upstream Doctors. Rishi Manchanda, welcome to Medical Matters. I want to start by asking you, what is an upstream doctor? You call yourself an upstreamist. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, an upstreamist refers to a healthcare professional like a physician or a nurse or another clinical professional who's not only engaged in patient care, but works individually with patients as well as within their clinic system to address, you know, all of the social determinants, those unhealthy social and environmental conditions that we know drive most disease in our patient population. So upstreamists are people who care not just about patient care, but ways of optimizing it by addressing social determinants of health. They have the tools, the training, and the equipment, and the support, more importantly, to transform their healthcare systems and improve outcomes at a patient and population level. So the reason I chose the term upstreamist, I came across a term, two terms actually, from Paul Grundy, who has been one of the champions of the patient-centered primary care movement. He's over at IBM and has convened a lot of the payers and other provider groups over the past several years in advancing the patient-centered medical home model. Paul talks about two segments of the healthcare workforce, the partialist, or we would think of as a specialist, as Paul says, the person who focuses on your left kidney or your right eye, and I think that's one component. The other segment of the healthcare workforce that he describes is the comprehensivist. And I like that term because it speaks to what I think a lot of primary care clinicians are being seen as or aspiring to be within the medical home, which is a provider as well as a coordinator of care working within the clinical team. I use the parable of the pretty well-known parable in public health. I adapted it a little bit to describe the upstreamist to add on to Paul's terms. And the story I tell is of three friends who come to a river. They all hear the sound of a child crying out for help, but they're in the river about to drown. So the three friends jump right in, they save that child, and to their dismay, they see other people in the water in need of rescue. Over time, pretty quickly, one of the friends says, I'm going to focus on the children at most risk of drowning, just at the waterfall's edge. Then over a period of time, a second friend says, you know, I'm going to try to coordinate some of the branches that are here by the riverbank and create a raft and help more people to safety so they don't have to end up at the waterfall's edge. And then over time, those two friends look up and they realize that their third friend is nowhere to be seen, even as the stream of people in need continues to increase. And they finally see their third friend swimming away from them upstream in the water, caring for patients and rescuing them. They shout out to her, where are you going? You know, we have people to save. And the friend shouts back, I'm going to find out who or what is throwing these people in the water. In the current way we think about the healthcare workforce, I think that it's important to think not just of the specialist or the partialist who's right there at the waterfall's edge, who you definitely want to be there to rescue people when they're in need of rescue, whether it's the trauma surgeons, the oncologists, the ER doctors. You also need the comprehensivist, and we're in that era right now, right, with the patient-centered medical home. But I think it's important to recognize that there's a third segment of the healthcare workforce that actually currently exists. They're already out there, and those are the people who are the upstreamists, the ones who are swimming upstream and trying to think about how to take their clinic system and address those social determinants. And I think if we think about the role that all three can play, we'll be that much closer to realizing a vision for a truly integrated health system as opposed to what a lot of people describe as a sick care system.
Okay, so I want to back up just for a second because you threw out a little bit of jargon there. The upstreamist is the one who's trying to go and, you know, essentially to the source of the problem as opposed to the downstream, stopping the children before they go over the waterfall. What do you mean by social determinants of health?
Yeah, the social determinants of health is a great term for academics and for researchers and for those of us who are advocates who think about this stuff, but probably not a great term for engaging people in thinking about them. The way that we can think about social determinants is simply the factors that affect our health, where we live, where we work, where we eat, sleep, play, etc. It's the structures that we live in, the buildings, the homes, the workplaces. It's the structure of our environment, whether or not we have paved roads versus bicycle paths, whether or not we're close to sources of pollution or far from them, if we're experiencing not just those kind of social or environmental conditions, but also elements that we also know impact our health, such as the power that we have to influence our decisions or even the lack of power. So there's studies from the social science and political science world that increasingly indicates that if you as an individual and certainly as a community have a certain degree of a sense of power, power defined as the feeling of and the ability to make a decision that impacts your life, those people and communities that have a sense of power tend to be healthier. Now, of course, that's a correlation, not necessarily a causation. There's a lot of research going out there. But the point is that social determinants of health is just a catch-all phrase used in academia to describe what I think a lot of people know instinctively, that health begins where we live, work, eat, and play. And that's in stark contrast to, I think, what some folks, including us in medicine, sometimes do a disservice by when we talk about health being something that is in the purview of healthcare. You know, health doesn't start in a doctor's office. It doesn't start in a hospital or a clinic. And yet when you ask people what's the one word that comes to mind when we say health, a surprising number of people will say things like healthcare or doctor or expensive or hospital. Health is not that. Health is driven by where we live, work, and play.
Well, are social determinants then, is it strictly an income issue or a class issue, or does it go beyond that?
Great question. There are two ways to look at these social factors. One is the social determinants of health that are like where we live, work, the factors that define our lives, oftentimes the more tangible kind of factors, right? So the nature of our housing, the nature of our work, the exposures that we have in the environment. So that's one level, the social determinants of health. And then there's another kind of layer to think of, which is the social determinants of health equity, or more importantly, social determinants of health inequity. And that's where we think of those are the determinants of how things like healthy housing or workplaces are distributed across populations or even across generations. So that's where class, income to a certain extent, racism, in a structural kind of historical sense, certainly do and are considered social determinants of health inequity. So when we think about the drivers of health, it's if we peel the onion once, we think of the social determinants of health in terms of the tangible built environment, the structure of where we live, work, eat, and play. And then if we peel the onion once more, I think the social determinants of health equity, of how those social factors are distributed, come into play. And again, that's class and race and more structural historical forces. So that's a helpful way to kind of think about those ways in which class and race and sometimes housing and other and education and things play together.
Okay, so then in your book, you give a paradigm example of how an upstreamist would work, and you lay it out, I think, early on, the story of Veronica, a patient you saw named Veronica. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so I share the story of Veronica in part because this discussion we've had so far about the social determinants can feel really academic-y, very distant, but it's really relevant day in, day out as a practitioner, as a physician. I share the story of Veronica to kind of drive that point home that it's a very real concept and there's actually very important things we can do. So Veronica is the name I used for a woman that I took care of 2 years ago now. She came into a clinic I was working in South Central Los Angeles. I was a primary care physician there, seeing a full panel of patients, about 26, 28 patients a day. And Veronica came in and shared a story. She had had a chronic headache, and she had previously tried to seek relief from primary care clinics in other parts of Los Angeles. Really not that effective. She felt like she was bouncing in and out of different primary care clinics without really getting the kind of sustained relief that she wanted, or more importantly, even an answer of what was causing her headaches. Finally, this episode of the headache that brought her into the clinic had been so severe for the past several weeks that she actually had gone to the emergency room about 3 weeks before I saw her. The emergency room had done a CAT scan of her head to see if there was any cause that could be seen on radiology. They did a number of blood tests. They even did a spinal tap where they inserted a needle into the lower part of her back to test for any infections or other abnormalities in her spinal fluid that could be causing these headaches. They ran her through an incredibly extensive workup. At the end of that first ER visit, they told her that everything came back, quote-unquote, normal, and gave her some pain medications and said, go follow up with a primary care clinician, and if the pain persists or worsens, just come back. And so she did that. She actually, the pain persisted, she followed instructions well, and she went back to the ER twice more. So she had a total of three ER visits, each one ended like the first. And now when she came into the clinic where I was working in South LA, she was exasperated. She had lost income because of missed days of work. Her family support structure was starting to be stretched. Her frail mother was being called in to take care of her two sons so that Veronica could try to get some relief and get some rest for her headache. And one of the worst elements of what had led to her exasperation was that a bill from the first ER visit for $1,200 had come in, and her monthly rent was about $850. So Veronica was in the clinic. She was exasperated, and she was still sick. And so that's the story of what presented to me when, as a provider, when I saw her. What I described so far and as I relate in the book, Veronica's story up until this point is unfortunately all too common, right? There are so many people like Veronica who come into the healthcare system. They're not people who are low utilizers, right? These are not people who are trying to stay away from healthcare. They're actually actively seeking relief, and yet they keep bouncing in and out of healthcare systems without getting the kind of relief. They end up getting exasperated, dissatisfied, lose trust with providers. They end up leading to providers often feeling frustrated that they're not able to care for her or provide relief. In fact, one of the ER physicians even accused Veronica of trying to just come in and seek pain medications because of her symptoms. You know, Veronica's story is all too common. It's all too common as a de facto standard of care. Individually, each of these clinicians didn't do anything wrong. They were giving her the most extensive workups, but at the end of the day, Veronica was still sick. She didn't know what was happening. So that's the standard of care de facto. When we saw her in the clinic, before I walked in the room to see her, I actually knew something about her that apparently no other clinicians knew. And it's not because I'm smart, but because my clinic was smart. My clinic system had been developed to respond to what the community had told us a few years earlier was a major driver of disease in South LA, which is slum housing. So we actually, as the upstreamist for the clinic, I worked with medical assistants and care managers and other members of our team to integrate screening questions about housing into our workflow. So the medical assistant that day saw Veronica, screened her vital signs, checked her, asked her for her chief complaint, and then she also asked her seven questions about, you know, whether she had roaches or mold or water leaks in her home. And when I got the chart, which was a paper chart, you know, this is still old school medicine before the electronic medical record was implemented in our clinic. When I got that chart, I saw that her vital signs were stable, that her chief complaint was a headache, and also that she had three of seven questions positive for living in substandard housing. And I turned the handle on the door, I walked in the room, saw Veronica doubled over in pain, and when she picked her head up, the first thing I saw was this crease across the bridge of her nose. It's called the allergic solute. As many clinicians know, it's a crease on the bridge of the nose that comes from chronically rubbing the nose. And oftentimes that can be a telltale sign of chronic allergies, of allergic rhinitis. So that jumped right out at me. It literally was as plain as the nose in her face. And I proceeded to examine her. Within 12 minutes, you know, again, she was the 17th patient out of my 26th patient day that day. Within 12 minutes, in talking with her and examining her, I felt pretty confident with the diagnosis was that she had chronic allergies, allergic rhinitis, and sinus-related migraines. Immediately when I told her that was my hunch of what was going on, she seemed to show some relief, at least knowing or having a sense of what was going on, provided her with some relief. And then I said, here's the treatment. We're going to give you medications for their symptoms, but we're also going to, if you're okay with it, plug you into a program where a community health worker will visit your house and help you learn about ways you can reduce the exposures to the mold and roaches and try to fix those water leaks, and if necessary, even connect you to the legal resources so you can advocate with the landlord to remediate those problems. So she left the clinic. We called her up 3 months later to come in so that we could follow up with her, and she came in and she was 90% better. She still had a few allergies here and there, but was a whole lot better. And here's the important point. It wasn't coincidental that her house was also better. She and her home were healthier, and that she had no more visits to the ER. She had no more visits to the hospital, no future bills that were coming in place. She felt better. The system had not seen any more unnecessary costs. She hadn't experienced any more unnecessary costs. She was happy with her provider. And all of this, for me, represents a better standard of care. That's the story of Veronica, the story of what an upstreamist and an upstreamist clinic can do when you try to optimize care.
This is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rishi Manchanda, who's a physician in Los Angeles. He's also the co-founder of a nonprofit called Health Begins. And he's telling us the story of Veronica, a patient who had no insurance, correct?
She, at that point, had no insurance, right.
Why couldn't the ER have asked those questions? Or why, certainly if it was chronic rhinitis, I mean, they did CAT scans and other expensive things, but they sort of couldn't come up with that? They were looking sort of too deeply?
It's a great question. And in fact, when I went back through for putting Veronica's story together for the TED book, I went back through the records, and for the records that were legible that I can make out, there was very little social history, if at all, accounted for. At most, the social history, if it was documented, was in regards to questions like, does she smoke or use drugs? You know, the kind of typical basic questions that tend to get asked, when in fact we should be tailoring the questions to the patient population, to the community. So it is a good question. Why did the ER ask us? And in fact, Veronica asked me that exact question. When she showed a flicker of anger on her face when she asked me on that follow-up visit, why didn't my doctors ask me about where I live? And I think the answer for that is, when we look individually at each doctor or nurse engaged in her care in the ERs and in the primary care system in general, and I think this is true for most patients, individually, providers aren't really practicing substandard care as an individual, right? They're all trained to, and in Veronica's case, they certainly were doing what they thought was the most appropriate thing for Veronica by testing her for making sure that there was no severe illness in the ER, or by using CAT scans or lumbar punctures or other tests. They were certainly all trying to achieve the best standard of care, and no one was negligible in any way as an individual. But the important point is that collectively, the primary care network that Veronica was engaging in, the ERs, essentially the healthcare as a collective really failed Veronica, right? We together in healthcare weren't providing her with a standard of care that we would want for ourselves. And certainly not a standard of care that we can afford to provide. If you think about the incredible amount of resources invested in trying to figure out what was happening with Veronica and the lack of return on that investment, you know, the fact that Veronica still didn't know what was wrong with her, still didn't have relief, was still in pain. So I think there are three reasons, John, you know, for why. There are a lot of reasons, but there's three big categories that I talk about in the book for why this is the case. There are regulatory reasons. There are cultural reasons, certainly in terms of the way we think of health and medicine. And then there's financial reasons. You know, regulatory reasons mean sometimes it's really hard for a healthcare system to actually get access to the data about where people live or where they work. You know, it's you don't often have systems in place or regulations certainly in place to allow for the sharing of data from housing or public health departments so that it can inform the kind of clinical algorithms or the data-driven approaches that we have in medicine. So there are regulations in place that prevent that. There's also regulations that sometimes even prevent the scope of practice for a provider to include the consideration or action on social factors like housing. You know, what does it mean, for instance, if a nurse is, or a doctor or a social worker, community health worker is responsible for or even can be held accountable for making sure that they ask questions that are tailored about people where they live in a robust way. So there's a lot of regulations that we have in place that prevent the integration of these social approaches in the ERs, like Veronica's case. The cultural reasons, I think, are a lot of folks in medicine know well, but, you know, there's been this rise in healthcare in the past 6 years, especially in the U.S., of this worldview in medicine that looks at the biomedical and the molecular at the expense of looking at the biopsychosocial, at the expense of looking at the health in its true context. And I think it's important to note health in the context also of justice, right, of trying to think about solving problems for those who are where the burden of disease is highest, many of whom tend to be the poorer, more vulnerable segments of our society. So the biomedical view has been dominant. We celebrate technologies and innovations that look at new ways to advance care at a molecular level or a genomic level, but very little is celebrated when it comes to trying to address patients in the context of their lives, even though that's just as personalized as a genomic screening. So there's cultural reasons, I think, that account for the fact that a lot of doctors and nurses and others haven't really considered or weighted the biopsychosocial as importantly in terms of career path. And the last and perhaps most important thing is financial, right? The reason that the ER doctors didn't screen Veronica is because they weren't paid to. Nor was I paid to in the ER, but we in our community clinic, but we, the community clinic, realized that where I was working, realized that it was in the best interest of the patient and actually in our clinic's best interest to actually more appropriately screen for social issues and try to address them. But in general, in the fee-for-service system where we have providers lining up and, you know, providing services that essentially account for their livelihood as opposed to a system that pays for value, that pays to try to keep Veronica out of the hospital, then it's no surprise that there's no kind of ingrained, integrated approach to thinking about the social factors in the ER. It's not because people are intentionally or individually practicing bad care, it's that collectively they're not being financially rewarded to do so.
Well, there was another part of Veronica's story that I found really compelling, which is you mentioned it almost cavalierly, but you said your clinic is smart and you asked some screening questions about housing, which it seems as though you felt empowered to do something about, which is a major barrier to overcome for most practitioners. I think in the book you said something like 4/5 of doctors know that social determinants of health are important, but only 1/5 feel empowered to do anything about it. And so you mentioned how you were able to just send a community health worker out to her home to assess, you know, whether there was an infestation or not. And I guess, can you explain a little bit more about what a community health worker is and how you had access to community health workers?
Sure. Yeah, community health workers are vital and I think underutilized segments of the healthcare workforce. They're still not formalized parts of the healthcare workforce in many states. A community health worker often is a person with a basic educational training, you know, a high school or a GED level, sometimes not even that, but somebody who, more importantly, actually has the knowledge and expertise of the community. They are from the community that they're trying to serve. They understand the cultural dynamics in that community. They understand where the needs as well as the resources are in their community. A lot of the community health workers that we currently think of in the U.S., certainly here in California, are coming the promotora model for the predominantly Spanish-speaking populations here in California. I know that in the Southwest especially, there's been a robust history of promotoras. So community health workers are serve multiple functions, and there's a lot of variety of functions that they serve in interventions across the U.S. Some are primarily health educators. Others are navigators for patients to go through the healthcare system. Some are care management extenders. They'll take a treatment plan that a provider and a patient come up with and try to make sure that the patient follows up on an appointment. They'll sometimes even monitor adherence to medications and other treatments in patients' homes. Some of them actually will then go out and do some surveillance. So they'll go into homes and screen for social risk factors like slum housing issues. So there's a variety of functions. I think the bottom line for what we were able to do for Veronica, and I think it's true for a lot of upstreamist clinics that have adopted this better standard of care, is that they tap into the expertise in the community, exemplified by the community health worker, but there's so many different models and resources in the communities surrounding clinics in the U.S., but there's this incredibly strong wall between a hospital or a healthcare system and the community that it serves, including the resources in the community. When clinics simply sometimes take down that wall and start to ask for help to address social needs for patients in the community, they often find a whole host of nonprofit organizations, public social service agencies, and others that have been there for a long time and have been eagerly awaiting, have been requesting and are eager to, I think, receive any indication from the healthcare system that they're willing to integrate and use their resources. So there are a lot of, I think there's a misperception out there among a lot of healthcare practitioners that there's not much we can do. And I think that's part of what explains what I call the don't ask, don't tell policy for social determinants in healthcare. We sometimes don't ask about social factors because we don't know what to tell patients if an unmet social need pops up. And yet, as you said, John, you know, 4 out of 5 physicians nationwide, according to a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study, you know, 4 out of 5 physicians know that social problems are as, they indicate this, they're as important as health problems for their patients. And yet only 1 out of 5 actually, as you said, feels equipped to handle those. Oftentimes it's simply because we don't tap into the resources in the community. So in Veronica's case, we simply partnered with a set of community organizations that had community health workers at the ready, and we said, can you help us? And they were more than happy to, and it took a lot of hard work initially to sort out what that would look like, but it wasn't that hard, and it was actually much easier than letting ourselves treat Veronica with some sort of model that didn't account for her social issues.
One of the things I think it's also important to point out, and you mentioned this in the book, is that, you know, legal advocacy is a big part of it. So the idea that doctors and lawyers working together to litigate, if you will, or take advantage of the legal code when legal obligations aren't being met by landlords or employers, that can lead to somebody's poor health. And so there's those legal advocacy partnerships. We've seen that a lot, and I think, in the pediatric world.
Yeah, the medical legal partnership model, I mean, a lot of it came from the pediatric world. There's also another historical root for the medical legal partnership model, which is from the HIV treatment and advocacy world. So those two threads historically in the U.S. at least have come together and produced a really flourishing movement of medical legal partnerships across the country. Many of them are based in pediatric settings, some are based in community clinics, some are based in hospitals, and some aren't just restricted to kids. They're in place for adults as well. In Los Angeles, I'm involved as the lead physician for a clinic for high-utilizing homeless veterans at the VA, and we are now the fourth VA in the nation to implement a medical legal partnership for homeless veterans. There's a broad set of applications of this model, and there's a wonderful center based out in D.C. called the National Center for Medical Legal Partnerships that is now kind of a convener and a network for providing technical assistance to other clinics that are interested in doing this approach, which at its basic is just bringing in public interest lawyers to work side by side with physicians and nurses to address some of the very significant legal factors that drive poor outcomes for patients, like the issues you mentioned. So whether it's slum housing or outstanding citations for criminal felonies or other things that sometimes prevent people from getting access to housing. There's a whole host of legal barriers that are totally outside the purview of doctors, but doctors know full well when they're addressed can help unleash great potential for health improvement among patients. So, yeah, the medical legal partnership, I think, is a wonderful emerging model of a social determinant intervention that can be integrated in a clinic. It's one of the interventions that we at Health Begins think about a lot when we're thinking about equipping upstreamists with tools that they can use in their clinics to optimize care.
I'm John Schumann. This is Medical Matters. Our guest today is Rishi Manchanda, who is a doctor and co-founder of a nonprofit called Health Begins. And we're discussing social determinants of health and a group of doctors and clinicians, not just doctors, but other types of healthcare providers too, that he calls upstreamists. And he, Rishi, you call yourself an upstreamist. And I wonder, is it a bit radical to call yourself that? Is there a radical part of the agenda to give yourself a name like that?
Yeah, it's a question that I hear sometimes. In fact, it's part of what I love the most about the connotation of the term upstreamist. Some people will hear the term upstreamist and they hear the word extremist within it. And I think the reality is when we look at the people out there in healthcare systems, many of the people I interview in the book, like the Jim Krieger is up in Seattle Public Health Departments, or the Mitch Katz, who's the director of L.A. County Department of Health Services, or the trauma surgeon out in Maryland who decided to go upstream by taking gunshot wound victim survivors and plugging them in with social services and had an 86% reduction in recidivism among gunshot wound victims again. So, you know, across the board, the reality is that the upstreamists are already out there, and many of them are working, innovating on the front lines of medicine every day because they've been going upstream not only to help patients but also up against a healthcare system that hasn't been geared to support that work in general. Some of them have had to develop skills that fall outside of what we think of as conventional in healthcare. So they tend to be excellent communicators, excellent visionaries. They're really well-versed in epidemiology and public health principles, knowing how to look at data. They seem to thrive in terms of team building, not just within clinics, but in clinic-community partnerships. They tend to understand change management, about how to move projects through a healthcare system, especially one that may not be receptive. So they understand how to demonstrate success, get an early win, and then build on that and achieve more change. So in that sense, these upstreamists are folks, you know, that you and I know, that many people, I think, might even recognize as they hear about this term. And so that, I think, helps to counter the view that there's some sort of radical element to them. If they're radical, then they're the best sort. They're already doing it, and they're demonstrating good results. Our goal with Health Begins, and I think for a lot of our partners, is to try to train and support more upstreamists so that the healthcare system can truly kind of achieve its potential.
How many upstreamists do we need, or how many more? If you have even a target number, how can we create more? Because it seems like the conventional way that we train health professionals really does have so much more emphasis on the biomolecular model than it does on the biopsychosocial model.
It's a great question. In the book, I propose that we need about 25,000 upstreamists in the healthcare system by the year 2020, and that compares favorably to the number of primary care clinicians and specialists that we project we need to have in the healthcare system by 2020. So primary care clinicians, general estimates are that we'll need about 260,000 physicians or clinicians in the healthcare workforce, and then another 450 or 460,000 specialists in the healthcare workforce. And in each case, for primary care and for specialists, there's a gap of about 60 to 70,000, sometimes as high as 90,000, you know, that we have to kind of fill to meet the demand that we anticipate. I add in the modest, relatively modest number of 24, 25,000 upstreamists that we need, thinking of a ratio of about one upstreamist for every 20 to 30 clinicians in a healthcare system. So with that in mind, the question of how we get there is something that we think about with Health Begins every day. So when we started Health Begins, it was because we recognized two things. First, there already are upstreamists out there. I was teaching myself how to be an upstreamist and learning from folks out there in the healthcare landscape when I was in South Central Los Angeles. And we started Health Begins to at least give that group of the healthcare workforce a network, a home, if you will. And then the second need was, of course, how do we grow this up? So there are very simple ways to do so. I think what we've done with Health Begins is to focus for the past year and a half on providing workshops in healthcare settings, going out to residency programs and community clinics across the country, and providing training so that we help clinics think about how to address upstream issues. And then in the process, we identify the clinicians who are in the midst of these clinics who are aspiring to be the upstreamists for their clinic. They're the ones who are already engaged in looking at quality performance metrics. They're the ones who are looking at population management issues, like how well the diabetics are doing in their patient panel, or how they're doing in addressing high utilizer patient populations. They're usually engaged in those kinds of activities. They're assuming more and more leadership responsibilities. And what they often indicate they need, and what we're trying to provide, is a bit more support to take their ideas for upstream interventions in their clinic and apply them. So we have in Health Begins, a six-step roadmap that we walk people through, regardless of the social determinants that they're interested in addressing, regardless of the setting. We kind of walk them through six steps they can take to address social determinants. We provide them with the learning collaboratives, it's about 700 strong right now, so that they can continue to kind of stay engaged and share best practices with other aspiring upstreamists, and even to learn from mentors out there. For instance, Jack Geiger, the father of the community health center movement in the U.S., is one of the lead upstreamists in our network, and we're privileged to have folks like Tom Bodenheimer and other kind of thought leaders in primary care part of our network as well, and as advisors. So the point is that we need a collaborative community to support these upstreamists so that we can get to that 24,000, with the ultimate aim, of course, of improving outcomes for patients, especially the most vulnerable patient populations out there.
Rishi Manchanda, how did you become an upstreamist? What led you on this path to thinking about health in a different way?
I became an upstreamist. I started upstream in my career, in my thinking of what I wanted to do when I grew up. When I was in college, I was really interested in political science and international development and health, and you know, specifically how those two elements of political science and international development related to health. So I went to India for a little while to do some field research and came across some states in India that, much like other parts of the world that a lot of folks know about, that have achieved incredible social development progress, but without much economic investment. So I visited a place in the southwest of India called Kerala that has total literacy, infant mortality rates that are lower than parts of the U.S., and yet at that point, at least, was the second poorest state in India, you know, a much poorer country than the U.S. And that really kind of, the fact that it went against the grain, that it proved that there was perhaps a different paradigm out there, was really appealing. It intrigued me. So I worked in India for a while and went back for a year after college to look even more closely at this intersection of health and community development. And I met a lot of people along the way who happened to be incredible role models. They were working on community-level issues. They were addressing issues like sanitation or housing. And some of them happened to be physicians who saw patients. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. So I came back to the U.S. I signed up for the National Health Service Corps, which is an incredible program. As you and others probably know, you know, helped pay for med school with the simple obligation that I return that scholarship with payment in the form of service to a community that's underserved in the U.S. And so I signed up for that without thinking more about it because it was a natural yes. So I signed up for the National Health Service Corps, did my MD and my MPH training. I was fortunate to get that. Came out to Los Angeles to set up my life here with my wife, and after finishing residency at UCLA in MedPeds, I finally was able to kind of get out back into the community, and through the National Health Service Corps, found myself in South Los Angeles, where I was asked to be an assistant medical director for a community health center, and I actually declined the offer and asked instead if I could be involved in medical leadership, taking care of some of the nitty-gritty administrative work, but to do so under the title of the director of social medicine. And to my amazement, the CEO, who is a visionary social justice advocate and a pretty savvy CEO in his own right, said yes. And that's what began a nearly four-year trial and error kind of process to learn about what it meant to be an upstreamist, the director of social medicine in the clinic. So I found myself, when I was in that job, and even to this day, kind of going back to my roots of what got me into this, which is to be a clinician who cares for patients and thinks about the context of the disease, and who's interested in social justice and community development issues, but is looking for a way to integrate those interests into my day job so I can do more work in an upstreamist kind of way rather than just being an advocate on the outside after hours.
Rishi Manchanda is a doctor, activist, and writer in Los Angeles. His book is called The Upstream Doctors. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. We welcome email from our listeners. Send us a line at glasshospital@gmail.com. Social determinants of health speak to what kind of culture and society we aspire to as a people or nation. One part of our current culture war involves the medical-industrial complex, the business side of healthcare that advertises, recruits, and sells things to us, mixing messages of commerce and science. Commentator Margaret McCartney explains why screening tests, highly valued in prevention, are not always as true as advertised.
In the UK, we get them too. Direct-to-consumer adverts from companies asking us, what would your doctor say if he or she could actually see inside your arteries? The usual setup is a church hall, community centre, or school. The adverts come with the urgent claim that only a set amount of appointments can be made for these full packages of screening, which we should see as good value because even though it costs cash, the reassurance of a health screening can be priceless. So what do you get? A cardiograph, a heart tracing, ECG, an ultrasound of the artery in the neck, the carotid and the abdomen, the aorta, and of the arteries in the legs. For a few extra pounds, you can also get a mini bone scan and a cholesterol test. The lure is magical. Health information, why would you not want to know about the state of your arteries? Why would you not want to know about whether your heart rhythm is in perfect order? What could be the harm of spending a bit of money on protecting your health? What could possibly go wrong? Well, to understand why I think these health screenings are oversold and close to a waste of your time and money, I have to tell you about screening. Medical screening are tests that are done in a person who has no symptoms of disease. This is what these companies with their healthy, happy headlines are offering. Screening might appear straightforward and sensible. Why on earth would you not want to know about a health disorder early rather than finding out late, possibly too late? Indeed, that is the kind of sales pitch that people get in the adverts and then come and see me with a screed of printout data promising to hold the key to a long, healthy life. But does it? In truth, screening is often counterintuitive. Take this example. Say there is a disease which is fatal. A blood test for the disease is 95% accurate and 1% of the population have the disease. You have the test and you test positive. But how likely is it that you really do have the disease? Most people will say 95% likely because the test is 95% accurate, right? But in fact, you are more likely not to have the disease. Let's go through the numbers. 1%. 1% of the population have the disease. That's 100 in 10,000 people. The test is right 95% of the time. So in that group of 10,000, the test will pick up 95 of those 100 people who really do have the disease. But the test is still only 95% accurate for the people who do not have the disease. That means that 5% of the remaining 9,900 people will test positive when they don't have the disease. That's 495 people. So the total testing positive are the 495 people who don't have the disease and 95 who really do. That's a total of 590 positive tests, but only 95 truly positive people. So if you test positive, you have a less than 1 in 5 chance of really having the disease. When I first learned this, I was overwhelmed. This was a 95% accurate test, but it performed amazingly badly in real life. Tests that look good but perform less well are only the start of problems with screening. To be useful, a result has to be able to deliver something. A test to look inside your arteries, well, no matter how pristine your arteries are, the advice to either minimise future damage or prevent it is the same. Don't smoke, do exercise, stick to a healthy weight, eat well, and don't drink excessively. As for going on to cholesterol tablets, this is a decision that can be weighed up with a risk calculator and doesn't become more exact for the sake of a carotid scan. Yet, some of the literature from private health screening companies talk about the need to scan the arteries in the neck, the carotids, in case surgery is needed to correct narrowings and prevent stroke. Here we need to balance the risks of leaving it alone to the risks of surgery. It's clear that when a person has had a stroke already and there is narrowing of the carotid artery, surgery is often useful to lower the risk of future stroke. But in people who have had no problems, that is, screening, the test is of far lower value. In fact, in both the UK and the US, our official bodies have made the recommendation that it should not be done. The reason is that the harm from operating is overall too high to make it overall worthwhile or beneficial to patients. So in the real world, this is what happens. A person sees the advert and thinks, sounds good. The person invests money in tests they believe might save their life. The scan shows a narrowing. The doctor who they take the result to advises against surgery. The person feels afraid of leaving this new problem alone, and because they weren't adequately advised to start with, a difficult situation is made even worse. Screening is always complex. Just like a drug, it has side effects. We need to know about these if we're going to make an informed choice, which is exactly what these ads don't tell you.
Margaret McCartney is a general practitioner and author in Glasgow, Scotland. Her book is called The Patient Paradox. You've been listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our program is produced and recorded at the studios of KWGS, Public Radio Tulsa, on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Medical Matters is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The show's theme music is by Europa 51. Original music during the broadcast is by Scott Griffith. This show marks the end of our four-part series of Medical Matters episodes. We hope to return in the fall with a new four-part series. For more information, check out our blog, glasshospital.com. Just click on the Medical Matters tab at the upper right. Questions or comments? Send us an email at glasshospital@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to Medical Matters, the program about healthcare and the human condition.